Republicans are running on their opposition to the Affordable Care Act, but a new approach in Arizona has Democrats using the law in their campaigns. How effective will the strategy be?
Advertising this early is pretty much a waste. It has very, very little impact on the eventual outcome of an election.
I'm Mark Brody.
And I'm Steve Goldstein. Today on the show, congressional campaigns take a new turn. Governor Jan Brewer is releasing her budget proposal this afternoon. We'll take a look at what's in it.
The governor also wants to make CPS its own agency, what that might look like and how it works in other states.
Just when you think you've seen every musical a high school could put on.
In a fun way, they're very emotionally attached to it. They want to see their work done right. And they have a huge buy-in to what they're doing.
Plus, the first big step since a merger, and don't forget the first rule of Fight Club.
Actually, it's okay. We can talk about it.
Oh, okay. That and more on the show after a check of this hour's news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. After months of debate over how much power is too much power, the Obama administration is out with a plan to rein in the National Security Agency. At the Justice Department today, Obama said the government should get out of the business of holding nearly all Americans' telephone records. But NPR's Scott Horsley reports President Obama stopped short of calling for other reforms that his own surveillance review panel recommended at the NSA.
President Obama acknowledged the potential threat to privacy of having the government stockpile telephone records, but he says someone needs to keep those records so they can be used to track potential terrorists. The administration will spend the next 2 months trying to figure out who should keep the records. Obama also wants a special surveillance court to give the green light before the records can be searched.
Liberty cannot depend on the good intentions of those in power. It depends on the law to constrain those in power.
Obama did not call for similar judicial scrutiny of national security letters used like subpoenas to collect information, nor did he call for a full-time privacy advocate to argue against the government in surveillance court. Scott Horsley, NPR News, the White House.
Within hours of Obama's announcement, the U.S. Supreme Court announced it would hear two cases testing whether police may search cell phones without a warrant when they arrest a suspect. Here's NPR's Nina Totenberg.
The court said it would review conflicting decisions from lower courts involving police searches of cell phones. In California, David Riley was pulled over on traffic charges, and when police discovered guns in his car, they scrolled through his cell phone, finding what they viewed as links to gang activity. Police subsequently got a warrant to search Riley's home and found evidence that led to his conviction. The California Supreme Court left the conviction intact, but across the country in Boston, just weeks later, a federal appeals court ruled that evidence obtained from a similar search could not be used at trial because the cell phone search without a warrant was unconstitutional. Nina Totenberg, NPR News, Washington.
Enduring a third dry year, California is formally under a drought emergency. Governor Jerry Brown announced today that his state will now be able to seek federal assistance. This as hundreds of firefighters spent a second day battling the 1,700-acre Colby Fire east of Los Angeles, and police questioned the three people believed to be responsible. Matt Gilham of member station KVCR is monitoring the firefighting operation.
Light winds overnight assisted firefighters in getting a handle on the Colby Fire. Forecasters are predicting highs in the mid-80s for the affected region. It is also the fifth straight day a red flag warning, signaling a high fire risk, has been issued. However, a slight cool down predicted for the weekend would increase humidity, assisting firefighters. Bulldozers, hand crews, and air support are all being utilized to battle the flames. For NPR News, I'm Matt Gillum in San Bernardino.
Dow is up 41 points. This is NPR.
Support for NPR comes from the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org.
Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. Along with Steve Goldstein, I'm Mark Brody. Governor Jan Brewer unveiled her budget proposal this afternoon for the upcoming fiscal year. To help us figure out what's in it, we welcome Howie Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks.
Glad to be here.
So CPS seems to be the big issue this session. The governor talked in her State of the State address on Monday of wanting to separate CPS from the agency in which it's currently housed. Does she give you a sense? Does she give us a sense of how much money she expects that to cost?
Well, at this point, we're looking at about $74 million. Some of that is one-time money. They think it could take up to $25 million to separate this new Children's Safety Division from the Department of Economic Security. But beyond that, you've got 212 new caseworkers plus support staff for them. They believe that this will help keep pace and also cut down the backlog. Because above and beyond those 6,500 cases that were never investigated, they're running a 10,000 case backlog, cases that had not been looked at over some period of time, and they say that's obviously not acceptable. So that's the big ticket item here.
Howie, in recent weeks, Speaker Andy Tobin and Minority Leader Chad Campbell had been talking about their support for restoring the Highway User Revenue Fund, or HURF. Any money for HURF in the budget proposal?
Zero.
Wow, zero.
Nada. Essentially what the governor said, and specifically John Arnold, who's our budget director, is, well, we're sympathetic to the idea of not funding the Highway Patrol through a fund that's supposed to go for road construction and maintenance, but we just can't afford it. So at this point, despite all of her talk during the State of the State speech about infrastructure, she's not prepared to put a bunch of money back that some people say legally and perhaps constitutionally belongs for road construction.
Howie, what does the governor say about funding K-12 education? She talked about some new student performance funding. What's in the budget in that respect?
There's $40 million in there. The idea is that we're going to essentially weigh each student's performance at the beginning and the end of the year using the standardized tests. And if you have students that are performing above average and staying above average, we'll give the school some extra money, you know, maybe $10, $20 per student. If you have a student who not only is performing above average, but has actually come from below average, we're going to give the schools extra money, perhaps an extra $200 per student. Now, that's the good news, is that there's new money going in, plus there is a $70 million in inflation funding. Not that the governor wanted us to fund that, but the Supreme Court ordered them to do that. Other than that, that's pretty much it for K-12 education. They have some long-term ideas about improving broadband for schools. There's no new money in there for additional repairs to schools. And it's pretty much a lean budget. Particularly for education. Universities, other than some parity funding for ASU and NAU to get them up to a per-student rate that they've already been paying to the University of Arizona, there's no new funding there. There's no new funding for state employees as far as pay raises and such. So it's kind of a, you know, the economy is improving, treading water kind of budget.
Howie, briefly, in about 20 seconds, editorialize for us for a second. I think some people might be surprised about the university funding, considering the governor's former chief of staff is now the president of the Board of Regents.
Well, in fact, what's interesting is after the governor gave her speech, the Eileen Klein, who, as you mentioned, is a former chief of staff, put out a statement saying, gee, this is all very nice. The governor wants a stable tuition. How about some additional money, governor?
Howard Fisher of Capital Media Services. Howie, thanks so much.
You're very welcome.
In her State of the State address on Monday, Governor Brewer announced she'd started the process of separating Child Protective Services from the Department of Economic Security. Arizona is not alone in this. Several states have standalone child welfare agencies. Linda Spears with the Child Welfare League of America calls Arizona's move a good first step, but only a first step.
Probably over the last 25 or 30 years, a number of states have done this, probably a few in the last handful of years, but states are always taking a look at what they can do to improve services, and while there are many arguments to keep those departments together, including that that both sides of the service system may be serving many of the same families, part of the challenge of running child protective services inside an agency that also runs TANF programs and Medicaid programs and all of those things is that the bureaucratic structure gets very big and gets driven by the places that often have large amounts of money. And child welfare, by comparison, is a small program, but it's a critical program that is a real safety program as opposed to a safety net program.
In the states that have done this already, in general, have kids been safer? Have the outcomes been better?
I don't know if it's better or not. I mean, it's not a cure-all. To me, this is a beginning of a process that it will allow the state, in this instance, hopefully, to be able to give priority attention to the requirements for safety, to the needs for policy change, for program improvement, for the dedication of the right level of resources to the functions of the child welfare agency. That said, you still have to attend to all of the things underneath it in order for the agency to work, whether it's standalone or not.
In your mind, is it easier, is it harder, or does it really not make much of a difference to make the kind of changes to a CPS program if it's by itself versus whether it's in a larger agency?
That, I think, depends a lot on the structure of the state, but I do think that it allows, if there are fewer levels of management in between the governor and the director, that right now that might allow for some quick movement of policies and procedures to change. So it might serve them very well in the near term around the changes that need to happen. Whether or not in the long term it makes that big of a difference, I'm not sure.
Is it reasonable to expect growing pains, for lack of a better word, once CPS is separate from the Department of Economic Security?
Yeah, I mean, in many ways, just my own knowledge of that agency is it had its own culture anyway. This gives it a chance to redefine its culture if it chooses to do so, or it can just continue the same old culture. But it gives them a chance to really focus. And one of the things where splits have happened, I do think that it allows people to really carry a single mission and mantra in their mind around the safety and well-being of children that isn't necessarily caught up in other stuff. But what I would be more concerned about than the culture, though that is a concern, is how they rebuild the connectors to the other support systems that were in their internal sister divisions that they now have to function across across an agency line with and rebuild connectivity with in a way that works, because they'll still need access to the things that are in DES as resources and services for the families that they are involved with.
Linda Spears is Vice President of Policy, Programs, and Public Affairs at the Child Welfare League of America.
The general election is 10 months away and primaries won't be here for at least 6 months.
But ads touting or criticizing congressional candidates have already started.
Americans for Prosperity has targeted two Arizona Democrats, Ron Barber and Ann Kirkpatrick, for supporting the Affordable Care Act.
Remember what he said.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan. Period. Period.
That's been called the lie of the year. Policies are being canceled. Premiums are going up. Patients are losing their doctors. Still, Congresswoman Kirkpatrick supports Obamacare. Why? Can't she see Obamacare is hurting Arizona families? Call Congresswoman Kirkpatrick. Tell her start putting Arizona families first.
But the House Majority PAC responded on Kirkpatrick's behalf this week.
It's here, in small towns and wide open spaces, that Ann Kirkpatrick listens and learns. It's why she blew the whistle on the disastrous healthcare website, calling it stunning ineptitude, and worked to fix it. She fought to hold insurance companies accountable so they can't deny coverage for pre-existing conditions or drop coverage when you get sick. Ann Kirkpatrick, seeing what's wrong, doing what's right. House Majority PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
Democratic strategist Bob Grossfeld of the Media Guys says the Kirkpatrick ad is very effective without running from her support for health care reform.
Well, I think the approach is right on target. You know, the onslaught of negative advertising having to do with the Affordable Care Act is just breathtaking in terms of the amount of money being poured into it. But there's still a story to be told in support of the Affordable Care Act that has to be done by Democratic candidates, particularly those like Kirkpatrick or Barber, who are in true swing districts where it's going to be a knockdown, drag-out fight. The Kirkpatrick ad in particular is doing the two things that really need to be done. It's acknowledging that there was a screw-up, but then also saying that she's in there trying to get it fixed. The implication being, instead of just trashing the whole thing, which is something nobody wants to see happen.
And Bob, do you think a lot of people will follow that mode? I know there's been criticism of some Democrats and even the president that they haven't been strong enough in their defense, and it's been more of a, let me try to wash my hands of this.
Yeah, I think there was a certain amount of wandering in the desert looking for how to fix something that was clearly broken, both in terms of the reality of, you know, the website, but also in terms of the perception, because the Republicans have been grasping onto this and like a junkyard dog.
The Kirkpatrick ad, as you mentioned, it acknowledges the problems with the Affordable Care Act and the rollout, but it also has really a positive side to it. It doesn't come across as some fire and brimstone kind of ad. Any reason to think if that's effective, we might see more ads like that?
Absolutely. I mean, at the end of the day, the whole negative ad beating the bejeebers out of somebody can only work for so long, and then it gets tuned out. One of the things that is notable that most people seem to ignore or just not know about is that advertising this early is pretty much a waste. It has very, very little impact on the eventual outcome of an election. It is critical, however, for the early positioning, the early who's going to win, who's not going to win, and especially the early fundraising. Which is frequently mentioned in terms of all of the coverage of these early ads. It's being used to no small extent, and particularly on the Democratic side, to point to the Koch brothers putting in billions of dollars or however much money they want. And the requirement that Democrats and progressives have to step up and do something on their own. So again, it's a fundraising device in many respects, much more so than advertising.
Democratic consultant Bob Grossfeld.
Ahead, a developer in Arizona embarks on an urban renewal project in a poor Phoenix neighborhood, but will it whitewash a rich Latino past?
There's really not an embracing of the Mexican-American culture. It's more the cowboy stuff, you know, the old West stuff.
That story ahead, it's the show.
Good afternoon. It is the show on KJZZ with Mark Brody. I'm Steve Goldstein. Valley weather for this weekend, a lot like we've been seeing all week. Sunny skies both tomorrow and Sunday with highs in the mid-70s. Currently, relative humidity is at 8%, sunny skies and 76 degrees at KJZZ.
If you're out on the Valley freeways this Friday afternoon, just one problem you should be aware of. It's on the 202 eastbound, the Red Mountain Freeway. An accident has the shoulder blocked at Scottsdale Road.
KJZZ is supported by Arizona State University, offering more than 60 undergraduate and graduate online degree programs. Class descriptions and registration online at radio.asu.edu.
American Airlines and U.S. Airways have started selling tickets for the other airlines' flights. It only applies to certain routes, including hub and international flights, and some of their East Coast shuttles. They've also started allowing frequent flyers to earn partial miles when they fly on the other carrier.
Next month, the two airlines will both be located in Sky Harbor's Terminal 4, and in March, U.S. Airways will join One World, a coalition of international carriers which Americans already a part of. KJZZ's Nick Blumberg looks at the continued challenge of pulling off the merger and who the airlines need to keep happy.
Don't let anybody tell you otherwise. Creating the world's largest airline is a tall order.
There are literally hundreds of thousands of decisions that you have to make.
John McDonald is a spokesman for U.S. Airways and American Airlines.
Throughout all the industry, we've learned from our mistakes. In those areas where we can make change quickly and it's easy to do and we can minimize the disruption, that's what we're doing. But we're also being thoughtful and deliberate about those kinds of things like computer systems and other systems that can really create some difficulty if we don't do them just right.
McDonald says all customers are important, but he acknowledges that business travelers make up a disproportionate share of revenue for airlines. But they often don't get much more than lip service, according to Joe Brancatelli. He edits a website for business travelers and says they value simple perks like extra legroom in economy.
American Airlines has a product called Main Cabin Extra, which is their premium economy product. U.S. Airways has nothing like it. How long is it going to take for Doug Parker and his crew to realize that this is a product business travelers want and need?
And Brancatelli thinks things like possible labor disputes down the road mean the merger won't be as smooth as the airlines have said.
Synergy is one of those words you mark down like a political promise. They talk about it while they campaign. It never happens. So I don't see the combined American U.S. Airways being any stronger than the two carriers were operating separately.
And they won't just face the challenge of finding the promised billions in synergies. They'll have to make some very specific policy decisions. Spokesman John McDonald told me about one such instance from a past merger.
One of the airlines allowed you as a second piece of luggage to carry antlers from an elk or a moose that you had shot at no extra charge, and the other airline charged that as an oversized piece of luggage. So you have to figure out how that works.
All right, well, I have to ask, does the New American have an antler policy yet?
Not yet.
All right. Nick Blumberg, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
There's a movement afoot to bring new money into urban areas all over the country, and surprisingly, Phoenix is part of that movement. The city has long been famous for its suburban sprawl, but now plans are moving ahead to link high-rise downtown with a neighboring Latino barrio that wealthy developers have ignored for the better part of 100 years. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Peter O'Dowd reports.
There are poor industrial neighborhoods in every big city. I'm standing in one of them with developer Feliciano Vera. With a good arm, you could probably pick up this empty beer bottle that we just found on the 14 acres of dirt he's buying.
Bottle of Cobra.
Give it a good chuck and clear the railroad tracks that separate Grant Park from the polished office buildings of downtown Phoenix. Vera plans to bridge this divide between rich and poor.
This is a condition that's existed that predates statehood.
For our community to go over the railroad tracks and for the downtown people to come on this side of the railroad tracks, it's like going to China.
I asked Eva Olivas to join us at the site of Vera's proposed development. She leads a group that works to improve the local neighborhoods. In Grant Park, trees and good sidewalks are scarce. Decades of industrial use have polluted the soil. In 2012, median income at $19,000 a year was less than half of what it was citywide. But Olivas says the area is rich with Latino history. In the 1970s, the now famous saying, si se puede, was coined just a few blocks from here during Cesar Chavez's fast for farm worker rights.
We have been waiting and learning and preparing for this moment. This community wants to support something.
That something could be up to 800 new apartments and townhouses, a third of them set aside for low-income residents. There's room on the empty land right under a flight path for another 300,000 square feet or so of commercial and retail space.
Let me ask you, so if we have a century or more of failure to do this, what in the world makes you think
what's different?
You can do this?
What's different this time?
The answer, Vera says, is timing. From Las Vegas to Detroit, American inner cities are revitalizing.
On the macro level, nationally, obviously we're going through this period of intense urbanization.
At a community meeting to discuss the project, residents Vanjie Muller and Nanette Parra fantasized about this urbanization.
Dream big.
Dream big would yeah. be to have
a grocery store.
But urbanization may just be another word for gentrification. Parra says developers put this neighborhood at risk.
They cater to those that are more educated, that are able to speak up, that are everything that our neighborhood isn't, that's what they cater to, and that's what we don't want.
So even though a grocery store and much more may be needed, residents worry the neighborhood's past as a Mexican-American working-class stronghold will be whitewashed, like it often is in Arizona.
There's really not an embracing of the Mexican-American culture. You know, it's more the cowboy stuff, you know, the old West stuff.
Earl Wilcox owns El Portal Mexican restaurant just across from the tidy little park this neighborhood is named after. His family is well connected politically, and he's used that clout to complain that the wrong development will threaten small businesses like his. Wilcox says competition from a big chain could wipe him out.
That's the fear.
And spoil the atmosphere of the entire place.
If they just come in historically and traditionally the way they do things, build it, and you know we'll worry about all these other things later, then there's going to be a lot of problems.
What if the developer recognizes Grant Park's Latino culture?
And it could be something really beautiful.
Peter O'Dowd, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
About a mile east of that proposed development, workers yesterday were putting the finishing touches on another project. This one turned an old warehouse into studio space. The ASU School of Art is moving some of its grad students downtown. School and city officials are celebrating the grand opening this evening. Michael Underhill is the interim dean of the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts, which houses the art school. He's excited to add to ASU's presence in downtown Phoenix, although he notes the studios are about a mile and a half away from the school's existing campus.
What it does for the students that are in the School of Art is get them more in touch with and closer to the things that are happening downtown. There's a vibrant art scene downtown Phoenix that they're very interested in, and so I think it's a real mutually beneficial that they're there with other artists that are downtown, and other artists that are downtown can participate in things we're doing in the school.
So also, presumably, in your mind, at least good for downtown as well to have these new artists coming in.
I hope so very much. I've been, as an architect, involved in some downtown infill housing for a long time, and I always felt like downtown had so much potential, but it's been a tough struggle. So ASU moving down there, I think, has helped. It's kind of turned the page a little bit on the possibility of development there and kind of more integration between people living there, working there, and the art scene that is very critical to downtown, always has been. But I think, in my opinion, the downtown campus has been a little bit too compacted. So one of the nice things about this is that we're going to be out on a fringe area, basically about 14 blocks from the other facilities that ASU has downtown, which will hopefully pull students into the community more.
You mentioned that the building, the studios are going to be a little bit on the fringe. It's also kind of an interesting building, right? Not a new construction.
Well, it's a terrific building. And so, ASU is very committed to keeping old buildings and revising them when that's the right way to go. So this is an old warehouse building, and there's always been a tradition in the United States of artists using warehouse buildings because of the interesting light-filled kind of energetic space that it provides. Michael Levine, who is an artist who's developing this building downtown, is the landlord for us, and we're excited to come there. And the building is going to be, well, the students and the faculty that have been working on it have just been really excited by it. You walk into it and you say, this is going to be a cool place to work, to do art.
Beyond just the fact of the location of the new building, sort of away from the rest of the downtown campus, do you think that having an art school and artists downtown will be different for the downtown area than having the other students, the other sort of courses of study that downtown Phoenix already has?
I do. One of my hopes is that the School of Art is, I mean, all schools do this to a degree, and all the different programs, public programs and journalism and nursing, et cetera, that are down there do this to a degree, but that maybe we can up the ante a little bit on the relationship between the kind of town-gown relationship where our students are down there bringing energy to the art scene and working together with artists that are already down there, so that we'll kind of continue the conversation about what good urbanism is, what a warehouse district could be, and what the kind of role of a university in downtown can be.
Michael Underhill is the interim dean of the Herberger Institute for Design and the Arts.
Not all that long ago, during a previous gubernatorial administration, the business community and many state lawmakers were enthusiastic about the future of biosciences. The industry was going to have a huge impact economically and medically, but the recession and deep budget cuts, among other factors, led to de-emphasizing biotech. Based on something Governor Brewer said in this week's State of the State, though, that may be changing.
It is imperative to have a stable, dedicated funding source for TGen to continue its valuable role as a catalyst in developing Arizona's bioscience industry.
Jack Jewett is president and CEO of the Flynn Foundation, a prime supporter of Arizona Biosciences. He's excited about the governor's State of the State push.
This is a good thing, and it's not without precedent. In 1983, Governor Brewer was a freshman legislator. I happened to be a freshman legislator at that time as well. And there was the creation of the Arizona Disease Control Research Commission, which was the predecessor organization to the Arizona Biomedical Research Commission as it exists today. That Disease Control Research Commission was established with a dedicated funding source.
How big an impact has the biosciences industry had in Arizona, both in ways that we can touch and in ways that maybe we're not going to touch yet, but we might in 5 or 10 years?
In fact, there has been an extraordinary amount of progress in the biosciences, beginning with the establishment of TGen. But we also look at the other dedicated funding sources that exist, the commonly known as the 301 money, the Technology and Research Initiative Fund, which is dedicated fund the universities and their research facilities that have come online. The Disease Control Research Commission, now called the Arizona Biomedical Research Commission, and that dedicated funding source. And certainly recently the activities around the Arizona Commerce Authority. We've come a long way, but as Michael Crow said at a meeting hosted by Flynn a year or so ago, in the biosciences, we're on the field, but we're not in the game.
Is there a feeling that when foundations get heavily involved, when the business community gets heavily involved, that lawmakers can sort of say, okay, that job's done, we don't have to really provide quite as much?
I think there is a tendency to do exactly that. And that's why I think those who are very close to the bioscience sector, our job is cut out for us, that we have to really help policymakers more deeply understand what's at stake here. And certainly there's a great deal of economic vitality at stake, but also when we think about the biosciences and we think about the medical breakthroughs, what we've begun to do in the last 10 years, and we look forward to an accelerated progress in the next 10 years, is we're building the infrastructure. Today's labs and research is yesterday's bridges and ports.
Jack Jewett, president and CEO of the Flynn Foundation. Arizona Republic columnist Bob Robb was surprised the governor mentioned funding TGen in her State of the State.
The governor had been party to eliminating previous funding for a different organization called Science Foundation Arizona, but something which also was in the business of promoting basic research, scientific research in the state, and had transferred that money, sort of, to her favored Arizona Commerce Authority. So it was a bit of a surprise to me.
Does this indicate that now that the recession has ended, state budget is a little bit more balanced, even with the structural deficit, that people are going to be moving more positively in this direction?
There's certainly a case to be made for government funding for basic scientific research of the sort that TGen does. But it shouldn't be done with the expectation that it will have a market effect on the trajectory of a big metro area economy like the Valley has. Supposedly it's something that gives you diversity and keeps you from being subject to the ups and downs of economic cycles. But the metro area that is commonly credited with having the most mature and active bioscience industry is San Diego. And San Diego had a terrible recession. Its peak unemployment was substantially higher than ours. And its recession, its recovery from the recession, has been significantly slower. It's simply, when you have an economy as large as the Phoenix metro areas, which is about a $200 billion economy, about 2 million employees, maybe 70,000 businesses, there's just too much going on for any single industry to be something that's going to be the fulcrum that's going to move the whole thing forward. Certainly the jobs in bioscience are good, but it's not the sort of industrial policy that you can count on to drive an economy.
Bob Robb, Arizona Republic columnist.
It's the show on KJZZ, and these are the sounds of the city.
I'm Perry Chopp, and today we're roasting coffee at Coffee Reserve. We do this for all kinds of customers, whether it's an independently owned coffee shop in North Arizona or a food distributor company like Shamrock Farms or Sysco. Today we have a really large order for one of our largest customers. They get three different blends from us, and they will typically order two semi-trucks of coffee every week, which is kind of crazy to see. It tastes pretty good.
That's Perry Chop roasting beans at the Coffee Reserve in North Phoenix. If you've got ideas or hear things that make Phoenix unique, send us a note. The show at KJZZ.org.
Arizona has 13 federal judges, well, at least 13 judgeships, but only 7 are currently filled, and that's left the working jurists with nearly unmanageable caseloads and a federal judicial system that has become severely backed up in the past few years. But relief may be on the way. After not acting to let 6 judges nominated by the Obama administration move forward to up or down votes, Arizona Senator Jeff Flake has submitted his largely symbolic blue slip. Now the nominees can be considered by the Senate Judiciary Committee. Paul Charlton, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona, describes the impact of the judicial shortage.
We have 6 vacancies in Arizona where there are supposed to be 13 judges. So if you think about your day-to-day life and going to work tomorrow and finding that almost 50% of the people who are supposed to help you in your job are no longer there, then you can begin to understand what our judicial system is facing here in Arizona. The workload has dramatically increased. These judges are working under what the chief judge a little over a year ago declared as emergency situation. So it is very difficult, and it's slowed the criminal and civil process down considerably.
And at its core, what does that mean? Does that mean people are denied a speedy trial? Does it mean that judges are not able to do their job as well because, frankly, they're overloaded?
We know the old maxim, and it is a truism, that justice delayed is justice denied. Criminal trials are taking longer to take place. Civil trials are delayed even more because criminal trials have to go first. These judges are working as hard as they can. The good news here is that this recent slate of 6 individuals who have been nominated by President Obama, who are outstanding candidates and who now have the support of our senators, will be, if you will, coming to the rescue and assisting the Arizona federal judiciary soon.
How quickly can new appointees get up to speed, considering obviously the other judges are going to say, terrific, the cavalry has arrived, here are some cases for you?
These candidates are experienced and fluent in all of the issues that they'll be required to address when they take the bench. They'll be up to speed very quickly. And really, we in Arizona have the benefit of one of the best federal benches in the nation. So we can be grateful for this new group of individuals joining an already stellar bench.
Paul, is Arizona more complicated? Obviously, when you were the U.S. attorney, you dealt with a lot of situations on the Native American reservations. We also have the proximity to the southern border.
It makes them more complicated. It makes them more voluminous. Arizona has one of the busiest districts in the nation because of our 370-mile border with Mexico. It is complicated because we have, in the federal system, jurisdiction over the 21 Indian tribes here in Arizona. And so as a consequence, the U.S. Attorney's Office is very busy taking care of cases it cannot otherwise ignore, and the judiciary is compelled to put those criminal cases before all of the many civil cases that are queued up and waiting to be addressed as well.
Is there a feeling that Arizona can, in fact, catch up, or are we always going to be playing catch up, as it were?
It's a great question, Steve, and we'll have to see what the curve looks like in the future. I think you're probably aware of the fact that Attorney General Holder is now reviewing which cases are deserving of criminal prosecution throughout the country. It may be that we see fewer drug prosecutions, for example, in the future. We can only hope that the new judges will begin to address the already backlog number of cases that we're viewing, and with that, find ourselves on an even keel soon.
Paul Charlton of Steptoe and Johnson, former U.S. Attorney for Arizona.
This is KJZZ. I'm John Hockenberry.
I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody. Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan is back to fighting Russians this weekend in the new movie Jack Ryan Shadow Recruit.
After a stint fighting IRA bombers, Arab terrorists, Hollywood has a problem these days. They want to sell movies everywhere in the world, and they need bad guys that don't offend a billion people here and there. Also, America's changing role in the world may make it hard for some people to see U.S. CIA agents as good guys.
James Furbish joins us now. He's the founder of the Sly Oyster blog and co-author of the essay Hollywood's Evil Men, a symbol of America's collective fears. James, welcome.
Thanks for having me on, John.
So in the 21st century, in an era of globalization and where we really need to, you know, be closer to China and Russia, for that matter, how hard is it to come up with a credible bad guy that's not just an alien or some, you know, robot left over from World War II?
I would say it's enormously difficult. We see this really for the past decade. It's been hard for Hollywood post 9/11 world. Having sort of Arab terrorists as the bad guy almost really hits too close to home. We see an absence of Chinese villains, perhaps because they're the, you know, largest untapped foreign box office market for Hollywood. And God forbid they risk having something negative financial ramifications by not having their movies shown in China. And, you know, we really see this reflected in sort of the use of superhero movies time and time again at the box office. These sort of cartoon caricature villains that are, you know, largely nation stateless, if you will.
Right. Yeah. The Joker doesn't come from anywhere in particular.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
Heath Ledger's mind, Jack Nicholson's mind, any number of actors' minds. What do you think of this notion of America's collective fears? How do you go about creating a composite that represents that?
You know, you do sort of see some patterns. It is interesting when you sort of look at some of these movies and what eras they come out in, and then, you know, how they almost do match up against some of the political and cultural anxieties that are going on of the day.
Well, the Cold War, you know, made it easy, I guess. And the drug wars of the 1980s and 90s also supplied a rich market of bad guys.
Yeah, absolutely. And you really see that, you know, the 70s and 80s, you really see this preponderance of, you know, corrupt institutions, urban decay. You know, this is sort of the golden era of the, you know, Hollywood cop drama, right? You know, we're talking about Bullet with Steve McQueen and, you know, Magnum Force and Dirty Harry, and all these movies really feature sort of failing government institutions, corrupt cops.
Who else knew where he was?
What are you implying?
Well, they knew where to look for him and they used your name to get in.
Are you suggesting I disclosed his whereabouts?
You believe what you want. You work your side of the street, and I'll work mine.
As the bad guys, you know, drug lords moving in. And yeah, it's really, you know, you can see that sort of borne out in a lot of what was going on in America as well.
And do you have a favorite evil character or evil character genre?
Perhaps because I came of age in sort of the 90s, I do have a fondness for what I like to think of as the sort of generic white guy of that era. Speed, you know, take your pick of any sort of Steven.
So Dennis Hopper, the bomber, right?
Yes, Dennis Hopper, the bomber, and Speed.
There's a bomb on a bus. Once the bus goes 50 miles an hour, the bomb is armed. If it drops below 50, it blows up. What do you do?
Tim Robbins, who is also a generic, you know, the secret bomber next door in the movie Arlington Road.
Oh, right. Yeah.
You know, there's The Rock with Ed Harris. He's the disgruntled military, you know, honorable military veteran who takes over Alcatraz. And you see this sort of in a lot of movies in the 90s where it's, you know, tends to be sort of this disgruntled white guy or, you know, kind of the bomber next door.
Well, and there are even some movies that actually celebrated the angry white guy almost as the good guy, bad guy as well. You know, I'll tell you, the scariest bad guy for me, bar none, is the old crazy Nazi in Inglourious Basterds, the Quentin Tarantino film. That
yeah.
one is certainly my favorite.
Well, and Christoph Waltz is just, I mean, he's a brilliant actor. You know, he seems to have a really great partnership with Quentin Tarantino. And certainly, you know, his work in Inglourious Basterds, horrifying.
James Furbish is the founder of the Sly Oyster blog and co-author of the essay Hollywood's Evil Men, a symbol of America's collective fears. Thanks so much, James.
Thanks for having me on, John.
Our partner, The Takeaway, is John Hockenberry.
KJZZ is supported by Theater League, presenting Man of La Mancha, an all-new production with the Tony-winning score and Don Quixote's quest for the impossible dream. January 17th to 19th at the Orpheum. Tickets at theaterleague.com.
Many High School Musicals sound a lot like, well, the movie High School Musical, but not at Arcadia High School. For the second straight year, students are putting on an entirely original production. It's called Shattered, and it tells the story of a new girl in town who's having trouble with friends, boys, and bullies. The show is about how the kids treat each other and the roles parents and society play in that. Theater students wrote the script, and students in the Contemporary Music and Sound program wrote the songs.
I think that last year there was always sort of this sort of lingering thought in the back of your head of, can you actually pull this off at a high school and have it be credible and not just be, you know, an educational experiment?
Richard Maxwell runs the music program at Arcadia. He, along with acting teacher Richard Fairchild, came up with the theme of this year's show, bullying, right at the start of the school year. But it was a group of around a dozen student writers who came up with the story. They took about a month to write the script and started auditioning actors in October. Junior Thomas Stewart is one of the writers.
Being in high school and other parts of school, everybody gets bullied, and it's something really relatable that is easy for teens to write about.
There were students who helped write the script who were also acting in the show. Senior Emma Coles plays Jennifer, the new girl. Coles describes her character as someone who's trying to figure out who she is and struggling with bullying along the way. She likes having a hand in creating the show.
You know all the backstories that didn't get into the original, like to the final script. So you know every thought that went through all of the writers, and you can really get a true sense of the character.
And I tried, and they treat me like crap, just like they treat everyone else.
The characters include students, parents, and grandparents, all played by Arcadia High students. Freshman Cameron Lizick helped write the script. She says it's the first time she'd ever done anything theater-related. So was it tough to write about something that hits so close to home for so many high schoolers?
It was difficult, as in writing from my own point of view, but it's something that I see all the time and I see every day. So in that aspect, no, it wasn't, because it's very realistic to what actually happens.
Teacher Richard Fairchild says many elements of the show came from the students. An absentee parent, how kids are bullied, a parent with a controlling boyfriend. That realism, by the way, is kind of a new development. Last year's original show was about aliens invading the school. Fairchild says the students take a lot of pride in their production.
In a fun way, they're very emotionally attached to it. They want to see their work done right. And they have a huge buy-in to what they're doing. And the script this time, they were so much more invested in, I think because of the subject matter, making sure that it came out just right and it told these stories just right and trying to represent, I think, themselves in a lot of those stories.
That applies to the music as well. Some of the songs were written specifically for the show, but students also submitted ones they'd already written. Junior Jade Lara has played drums in both original shows. She submitted her song, Favorite Things, for Shattered. It closes this year's performance.
Just personally, I started writing like around like seventh grade or so, just like for funsies, I guess. But it's cool that now they're being put to like huge scale things, at least for the most part, and not just staying in a notebook, you know?
Some of the other writers and actors say they like being able to play a role in shaping their characters, making them more real. Richard Maxwell says some of his students started asking him about the show as soon as the last one ended. And with due respect to Grease, The Music Man, West Side Story, and any of the other traditional musicals high schools put on, Maxwell would like to make an original production an annual thing.
It's not to say that we don't want to do, you know, the quote, normal published musical again. I don't see anything wrong with that. There's great value in that, you know, educationally and artistically and musically and everything else. But I also think that this is an experience that they can't get anywhere else.
The musical Shattered made its debut last night. There are more performances scheduled for tonight and tomorrow.
I'll count my stars, you're my favorite thing by far. Yeah!
It's the show on KJZZ at 248. Valley weather, looking for a nice weekend, and a lot like we've seen the last week or so. Temperatures about 10 degrees above normal. Highs both tomorrow and Sunday, probably around 77. It'll cool off just a little bit in the early part of the week. Currently, relative humidity is at 8%, sunny, and 76 degrees.
Elsewhere around the state right now, sunny skies throughout Arizona, 51 degrees in Flagstaff, 55 at the Grand Canyon. It's 59 in Prescott. In southern Arizona, 74 degrees in Tucson, and around the valley, 72 in Chandler, 73 in Scottsdale, 73 as well in Glendale. As Steve said, sunny skies over Phoenix, 76 degrees.
KJZZ is supported by Barrow Neurological Institute at St. Joseph's, exploring the wonders of the human brain and spine for more than 50 years. Here's to the brain and the neurosurgeons and specialists that care for it. AmazingMedicine.com.
Across the country, the legal landscape for same-sex marriage is changing and fast. In recent weeks, courts in New Mexico and Utah have delivered victories to gay marriage proponents. Now here in Arizona, some gay and lesbian couples are challenging the state's definition of marriage. From Phoenix, KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reports.
She's soup for supper tonight.
Terry Pochert is serving up soup while his husband Joe Connolly puts the final touches on a salad.
We like no-fuss meals.
The couple, both registered Republicans, have been sharing no-fuss meals for almost 19 years. Before they eat, the two men bow their heads.
Come, Lord Jesus, be our guest. Let thy gifts to us be blessed. Amen.
Pochert and Connolly's Lutheran faith is a big reason why they've decided to challenge Arizona laws that don't recognize same-sex marriage. Joe Connolly.
Gay and lesbian people in this state, in faiths where they allow same-sex marriage, but the state does not, it's denying people of gay and lesbian people of faith the right to the sacrament of marriage.
The couple was married legally in California in 2008. Terry Pochert.
It would have been wonderful to have a church filled with people here and our own congregation and our friends, but we just couldn't do it here in Arizona.
Many in the state believe allowing gays to marry would infringe on their own faith, and they've already weighed in. In 2008, Arizona voters approved a constitutional amendment that defined marriage as between a man and a woman and reinforced existing state statutes. Earlier this month, Pochert and Connolly filed a lawsuit with three other couples challenging those laws. Sean Aiken, a lawyer who normally specializes in business law, is representing them.
This is a bit far away from the work that I normally do, but what makes it so exciting, I think, for me and every lawyer is these are the kind of cases that we hope to be involved in.
Why? Because Aiken and others hope cases like this one will be landmark civil rights cases. Last June, the Supreme Court struck down part of the Federal Defense of Marriage Act, which denied federal marriage benefits to same-sex couples. Aiken's suit relies heavily on that decision.
And to put it simply, it's to say, why can the state government do what the federal government cannot?
The Supreme Court ruling gave same-sex advocates a lot to celebrate, but it left a big question unanswered. Can states ban same-sex marriage? Douglas Nijame is a UC Irvine law professor.
It really opened the floodgates to litigation, both by folks inside the movement and folks outside the movement. So that's why we've seen now almost 40 lawsuits pending around the country in a variety of states.
Lately, the pace of change has been dizzying. In New Mexico, the state's highest court ruled last month that same-sex couples could marry. The next day, a federal district judge in Utah struck down that state's ban. Federal judges in Ohio and Oklahoma have also sided with gay couples. But despite this, Nijame says this legal debate is far from settled.
Even though we've seen district courts favoring same-sex couples' claims in the last few weeks, we're likely to see just other decisions come out the other way.
In other words, future rulings might say that states can choose to only recognize marriages between a man and a woman. In the past, uncertainty in the courts meant the LGBT movement attempted to carefully plot out its legal moves. But that's changed with the recent flurry of new litigation happening all over. Jenny Pizer from the national LGBT law firm Lambda Legal says the energy is exciting, but it's vital all parties pushing for change coordinate.
With any issue where a court case affects not just the litigants, but a whole community of people, folks in that community try to plan and work together to try to have good results in cases like that because everybody has to live with the result.
Any one of these pending lawsuits could wind up in front of the Supreme Court, which then would decide for the whole country whether states must recognize same-sex marriage. Jude Joffe Block, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Arizona is home to nearly 200 museums, and there's one in the valley that may spark your interest. KJZZ's Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez tells us of a hidden Phoenix hotspot.
When you think of firefighting equipment, you think of flames, firemen, and those large, loud fire trucks. Sure, we know they're there to save lives. Ever think of them in a museum? Did you know the Hall of Flame Fire Museum is believed to be among the best of its kind?
This is the largest historical firefighting museum in the world, as far as we know.
Mark Moorhead is the education curator at the Hall of Flame Museum. He says the museum was reestablished in Phoenix by an Illinois family who relocated to the area with its firefighting equipment collection in the early 1970s. And over the years, donors have added to the exhibit.
We're the biggest, and our scope is actually international. Most of the pieces are from the U.S., but we do have some from other countries.
The museum is located on Van Buren, nestled behind the Phoenix Municipal Stadium. There are more than 80 pieces of firefighting equipment on display, dating from the early 1700s to the 1970s. From hand pumpers to fire engines once used in Japan, Ireland, England, Peru, and the U.S. There's even a 1951 fire truck for kids to play on.
We have a lot of fun, and it's a little more informal maybe than some museums. We have a lot of fun with kids here, you know, lots of field trips. But it is actually a serious historical museum for adults, too. Among historical fire museums, we try to trace the whole social and technological history of firefighting.
There are numerous displays showcasing the trade, from thousands of fire department patches to fire alarm paintings, uniforms, and helmets. Some of the dozens of helmets on display belonged to fire departments in Germany, Japan, and Cuba in the early 1900s. There's also a National Firefighting Hall of Heroes exhibit honoring the men and women who died in the line of duty, including the 19 Yarnell firefighters and a 9/11 memorial.
We have the pictures of all of the firefighters from the New York City Fire Department, the police officers from NYPD and also from the Port Authority, including a canine officer. We have a piece of the Twin Towers, which was given to the Phoenix Fire Department by the New York City Fire Department as a thank you for their help with the cleanup.
What's a firefighting story without its mascot, the Dalmatian? There's also a display honoring this devoted companion. In the 19th century, Dalmatians were used as guard dogs to protect the horses and to run and bark alongside the fire truck, announcing its arrival. But not all stations followed tradition. Moorhead says the Phoenix Fire Department's first mascot was actually a goat named Homer. It's the show. I'm Nadine Arroyo Rodriguez.
Five reps. Let's go. Get on your heels. On your heels.
The first rule of Rush Club is, well, you are actually allowed to talk about Rush Club. In fact, a lot of people are talking about it.
This competition in downtown Phoenix is described as functional fitness meets fight club. AJ Richards started Rush Club with personal trainer Stacy Snyder last February.
So we had this thought, what if we put functional fitness athletes head-to-head in an environment where it was all eyes on them, sort of like you would see in an MMA fight?
Unlike in the movie Fight Club, competitors, both men and women, go head-to-head by working out. Two participants complete exercises on a stage surrounded by spectators for the chance to win cash prizes and become king of the roost.
It is not a contact sport. It's very friendly. The winner generally will turn around and cheer on the person who's behind them. And then when they're done, it's a high five or a hug. Because there is no conflict between me or my opponent. We're both out to accomplish that same task.
The eighth competition is tomorrow, called the Final Rush. It'll celebrate nearly a full year of Rush Club. The winners of the previous competitions will return to compete in this event, including a few champions from California. This rematch of sorts is expected to draw more than 500 spectators.
Come on, you got it. Good job. All right.
Richards owns Rush RX CrossFit Gym in Mesa. The gym is mostly empty. No treadmills, no stationary bikes, no protein smoothie bar.
Functional movements, says Richards, emulate everyday movements. A power clean, for instance, is sort of like picking up an object and putting it on a high shelf.
Except in this gym, the object is a barbell that you haul from the ground up to your shoulders and then drop. Richard says anyone can work up to a competitive level of fitness, and Rush Club is still evolving to accommodate different people.
We're transitioning what we do into a weight division sport, which has never been done in the functional fitness community, and some of the top athletes and coaches in the community have been waiting for something like this.
In these competitions, winners will be challenged by newcomers for their title, a little Iron Chef meets Fight Club. It's always a busy weekend around the Valley. This Sunday morning is the P.F. Chang's Rock and Roll Arizona Marathon and Half Marathon. Get started at 7:50 a.m. Neither Mark nor I is participating, but you can be sure Mark's going to be kind of next there stretching, I'm sure, kind of getting those hamstrings loose.
I'm not sure there's enough stretching in the world for me to be able to run a marathon or even a half marathon, just a hunch. If you're not into the full marathon, there's a Run for Hearing at the Phoenix Zoo. It's an event. It also has a fun run for kids age 10 or younger. All proceeds benefit the Olive Osmond Hearing Fund.
A lot of car stuff this weekend as well, as the Barrett Jackson Collector Car Auction wraps up at Westworld. Also, tonight through Sunday, Russo and Steele Automobile Auction. That's at the 101 and Scottsdale Road.
If you want to celebrate the Chinese New Year, you can do so on Sunday afternoon at the Chandler Center for the Arts. This is, you will be happy to know, the Year of the Horse.
The show was produced this week by John Hoban, Nick Blumberg, and Nadine Arroyo-Rodriguez, with help from Tiara Vian, Annika Klein, Alexandra Olgan, and Kendra Sabo. Tracy Grew and Julie Levin make up our digital team, the managing editor, Al Macias, and news director, Peter O'Dowd.
We always want to hear from you. Let us know what you think, good, bad, or ugly. You can, if you have story ideas, send us those as well, the show at kjzz.org.
If they're ugly, maybe not photos, though.
Yes,
so we get enough of ourselves in the mirror. For Mark Brody, I'm Steve Goldstein. Hope you have a great weekend. This is listener-supported KJZZ FM Phoenix and HD. All Things Considered is next at 3 o'clock.